Today from Springfield, Missouri, the American Broadcasting Company brings you an address by the President of the United States. Mr. Truman has journeyed to this Midwest Missouri community to attend the annual reunion of his World War I outfit, the 35th Division. It will be the last reunion he will attend as Chief Executive of the United States. The President's speech, delivered from the Shrine Mosque in Springfield, is expected to cover the military situation. Mr. Truman will be introduced by the Governor of the State of Missouri, the Honorable Forrest Smith. Governor Smith. The honors are now Governor Forrest Smith.
President and friends, all of Missouri is proud of the fighting 35th Division. It's the best known division in the world. It can boast of having one of its members, the first man of our nation. I give you a fighting son of a gun, your own buddy, His Excellency, the President of the United States.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Governor, I thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. I hope I can live up to it. I'm very happy to be with you again. I always enjoy these reunions. In my present position, I review a lot more parades, but this is one place where I can march in one, and that's unusual. I was in St. Louis 2 years ago at the 30th reunion of the 35th Division. I talked to you about world peace and about the necessity of building up the defensive strength of all the free nations. A great deal has happened since then. Today, I want to talk to you about the progress we have made since 1950. And I want to point out some of the dangers that now threaten us. When I talked to you on June 10th, 1950, I told you how the Soviet Union was threatening the peace of the world. I told you that the Soviet Union was engaged in a tremendous military buildup, and that we, together with our allies, had a long, hard road ahead of us. There were a lot of things on my mind when I made that speech to you in 1950. You remember that the Soviet Union had set off the first atomic explosion in the fall of 1949. Shortly after that, I directed the top officials of our government to make a new study of the foreign policies and the military potential of the Soviet Union, taking into account the fact that the Soviet Union now had the secret of the atomic bomb. I directed our officials to try to find out whether the Soviet Union was headed for war and what we should do to deter and prevent such a conflict. These officials worked together through the new National Security Council under my direction, and it came up with their preliminary answers in April 1950. These answers presented us with some very difficult problems. It seemed clear as a result of this study that the United States and all other free nations were faced with a great and growing danger. It seemed clear that we could meet the danger only by mobilizing our strength and the strength of our allies to check and deter aggression. This meant a great military effort in time of peace. It meant doubling or tripling the budget, increasing taxes heavily, and imposing various kinds of economic controls. It meant a great change in our normal peacetime way of doing things. These were the problems that were being laid on my desk at the time I spoke to you in St. Louis in 1950. Just 3 weeks later, the communists invaded the Republic of Korea. That made the danger clear to everyone. The invasion of Korea demonstrated to all free nations that they had to have much stronger defenses to prevent Soviet conquest. As a result, the free nations have been moving forward since the middle of 1950 to build bigger defenses. Our own country has taken the lead because we are the strongest of the free nations. We've made a lot of progress in 2 years. We've reached a number of the goals we set for ourselves back in 1950. We still have a long way to go in many respects, but if we stick to our course, we can create the kind of strong, free world that we need to guarantee security and peace. We can win the peace, and we're going to win the peace. Now, there's been a lot of loose talk lately to the effect that our defense program has been a failure. Much of this talk is politically inspired, the kind of talk you would expect in an election year. But I want to set the record straight. I want the people to have the facts about our defense program and our national security. Let me give you some examples. 2 years ago, we had an Air Force of 48 wings with 400,000 men on duty and less than 9,000 planes in active use. Now, we have an Air Force of 91 wings with almost 1 million men on duty and nearly 15,000 planes in active use. These figures refer to the Air Force only. They do not include the big buildup of air power in the Navy and the Marine Corps. The goal we set in 1950 called for 95-wing Air Force by midsummer 1952. 91 of those wings are now operating, with new and better planes coming into service all the time. Within 2 months, we expect the four remaining wings to be in operation also. In the last 2 years, we've tooled up the aircraft industry to produce the best planes being built anywhere in the world. And we are turning them out. Listen to this. And we are turning them out at better than 4 times the pre-Korea rate. Some of you may not realize what a great accomplishment this really is. We all remember how rapidly our factories turned out planes in World War II. And we are inclined to think we should be able to do the same thing now without any trouble at all. But the program is a very different one today. There are 2 main reasons for this. The first is that the planes we are building now are far heavier, far faster, and far more complicated than those we were building 7 years ago. A new jet fighter bears about as much relation to the old P-40 as a 1952 Cadillac or Chrysler bears to a Model T Ford. Both planes fly. And there the similarity ends. The design, the power unit, the fire controls, and everything else are different and far more difficult to make. And it is the same way with all our new models. A second reason is that we are in a race for technical supremacy. The nation that freezes its models too soon will be a nation with an obsolete, inferior air force. In World War II, it was my business to investigate the construction of airplanes. At that time, it took 18 months to get a plane from the drawing board off the end of the line. And when that plane came off the end of the line, it was obsolete. We don't want to have a situation like that, and we're not going to have. The Air Force we're building now is an Air Force of the highest quality we can possibly provide. We're concentrating on production of the very latest types of planes, and we are constantly working to design and produce even better planes. We're not trying to build the biggest Air Force in the world. We're trying to build the best one, backed up by the industrial capacity to expand it rapidly if need be, and keep it always up to date. Of course, this costs money. It costs a lot of money. You may have heard some nonsense in recent days to the effect that we could save money on our national defense by building up a gigantic air force. Anyone who has that idea forgets that modern air power is a very expensive proposition. Some of our new jet fighters cost as much as $600,000. 9 times the price of the average fighter plane used in World War II. A B-36 bomber costs $5 million today when everything is figured in, compared with only $800,000 for the B-29 7 or 8 years ago. And the B-29 is just as obsolete now as the cars of 1938. We need new appropriations of more than $22 billion this coming fiscal year just for the Air Force, of which $11 billion is to buy new aircraft. A big, powerful Air Force is an absolute necessity, and we're going to have one. But don't let anybody tell you that it won't cost any money. It'll cost a lot of money. Our plans now call for building up from 95 to 143 active wings in 2 or 3 years. We have a similar expansion underway for the air units of the Navy. These will be terrifically powerful air forces when we get them all complete. And at the same time, our aircraft industry will be ready to go rapidly into full-scale war production of the latest models, should that need ever arise. God forbid that it should ever arise. We're making progress in building up our air forces here at home without in any way neglecting the needs of the forces in Korea. There's been a terrible amount of misinformation about our situation in the air in Korea. To hear some people talk, you would think we were completely outclassed over there and at the mercy of the Russian-made enemy air force. In the air combat, in Korea, our planes have knocked the Russians out at the rate of 8-1. You can read that in the newspapers if you want to. They can't prevent us from publishing that. You know that isn't true about us are not being properly prepared in Korea. Here are the facts. We have been able to maintain air supremacy over most of North Korea. That means we can bomb the enemy at will almost anywhere in his territory. The northern border and the Yellow River, we do not have supremacy. But we do have clear superiority in air power, which means we can reach our objectives even though we have to fight off opposition. We grow a greater debt than we can ever pay to all the gallant airmen who have fought so valiantly to hold the Korean air for the United Nations. It is our duty to make sure they receive the finest and most efficient modern weapons to keep up the fight. And that we are doing. The United Nations forces in the air are being kept supplied with the planes they need for the tasks assigned to them. All we have done and are doing to build up our air power is matched by our expanding land and sea power. The United States Army has been doubled in size these last 2 years, and it is being re-equipped with the finest of modern weapons. These weapons would astonish you. We're getting these weapons now in quantity. For example, one of our best new tanks is now coming off the production line at the rate of well over 300 a month, and the rate is rising very fast. As for the Navy, there are twice as many ships in full operation now as before Korea, and our naval ships and weapons are improving all the time. There are some amazing new technical developments in the Navy. I shall have more to say on that subject next week up in New London, Connecticut. With all the progress we've made, we still have a long way to go before we reach the strength we now consider necessary to the national security. We've just about reached the objectives for this summer that were set out 2 years ago when the mobilization program first began. If we can do as well the next 2 years, we shall have a right to be proud of ourselves and to feel that the world is safe. 2 years ago, when I was talking with you in St. Louis, I said a great deal about the need to help our allies build up their defensive power. The study that was made by the National Security Council in 1950 made it perfectly plain we could be secure against the communist menace only if other free nations were secure too. Only if the strength of our allies was added to our own. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was just getting started at that time. To be effective, it needed many things. It needed a more closely knit, a more clearly unified Europe behind it. And it needed real arms and real fighting forces. Those were some of our problems 2 years ago.